Welcome to the Literary License Podcast, European Horror Podcast, with your co-hosts Vicky Ray, Will Millar, and Keith Chalko, exploring the genre from a unique perspective, from extreme to classic, in a world that is set to chill you to the bone.
Hello, welcome to Literary License Podcast, and today we're discussing, for our European horror segment, Possession, the 1981 film. And of course, we are still continuing with our Obsessive Love Disorder Month. And today we have with us Vicky Ray. Hello, Vicky.
Hello, everybody.
And Will Millar. Hello, Will.
Hey, gang. How's it going?
It's going.
And before we get started, instead of talking about certain things like we normally do, we're doing a thing called Roses and Thorns. Roses and Thorns, basically, is we discuss one thorny issue that bothered us this month or pissed us off, and the rose, one thing that we actually loved or liked this month. Well, for Vicky and I, it will be a weekly thing, so because Will is monthly, it'll be a monthly thing from him. And so we'll start with you, Will. What's the thorny issue this month for you, and the thing that you love this month?
The thorny issue I have this month. I'm not going to pick out any like one thing, because I tend to stand on the opposite side of the fence of a lot of people where it comes to celebrity culture. And so I just want to, in place of speaking to anything specifically, I'd just like to remind everyone that the Smith Month Modernization Act happened in 2012. Pretty much everything that you're seeing now on the news is fake, like literally all of it. And this isn't like a Trumpian fake news thing or anything like that. It's fake on all sides, and it's engineered to be fake through a lot of the analytics that were collected through Facebook in the last, 4 or 5 years. So if you're playing those games that, tell you whether or not you're a Targaryen or a Stark, then you're also getting a lot of, you're getting a lot of metadata collected about you.
And I'm a Stark.
Yeah.
I like the Targaryens too.
And you're getting Stark propaganda just kind of beamed at your face 24 hours a day. So I just want to, close this by saying the people who live in the Middle East do not represent the greatest threat to your freedom. The people who are telling you that the people in the Middle East represent the greatest threat to your freedom are the ones who represent the greatest threats to your freedom. Be careful about the news that you consume, okay? It is literally warping a lot of people out there.
That's why we have Amazon Prime and Netflix.
Absolutely. That's my beef of the week, or my thorn.
Works for me, Will.
Yeah, cool. So are we talking roses right away? We jump.
Yep. What's your rose of the week or the month?
My rose of the week is actually my friend's movie. So I'm going to be talking about this at the end too. But there's, if you guys are into, tentacle monsters and sort of the crazy horror that we're getting into today.
Clearly you're into tentacles.
Well, everybody's got to have a thing, Vicky, no, but if you want to see a less, gonzo, I guess, version of this sort of sci-fi, check out Intercept the movie. It's a great low budget sci-fi that's going to be coming out next year, and it's run by some really cool people.
What's it called?
Intercept. If want to Google, because you've got to get really specific on Google with indie stuff sometimes, look up Intercept the movie, all one word, and it'll take you right to some of their making ofs. And
awesome, will do.
Really cool. So,
and what about yourself, Vicky? What is your rose and thorn of the week?
Well, my rose today, I would say, it's my mom and dad's anniversary. Happy anniversary, mom and dad. They've been married 62 years. And,
happy anniversary.
Yeah, I'm just glad they're still alive and in my life and on the planet. And do I do my thing that drives me nuts the most, that I dislike, please, this week? It would be animal abuse photos on social media because I can't scroll past the pictures fast enough. I know it exists. I'm an animal lover completely, but I don't want to see that shit. And it's just like, please don't post people like Chinese guys putting dogs in large walks with huge spoons and whatnot, boiling them. I don't want to see it.
So I take it that you're a friend of my sister's on Facebook.
Well, it wasn't her post per se. I actually couldn't. I had to unfollow this person. It's just such heinous stuff. And I know it exists. Cruelty exists everywhere, but sometimes I don't want to see it with my morning coffee, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I know it exists. Please don't throw it in my face of animal suffering, because animals don't deserve to suffer. People do, but animals don't. Like, don't do it to animals, please.
Well, I could just sit there and say that, I unfortunately, the person who does that on my Facebook page is my sister. And this is like, it is like pages and pages of like, abused dogs and pets, and I
well, it's the act itself that's like, you know, you can't get past it quick enough, and it's rolling already. I can't get past it quick enough, and I can't unsee it. Now it's stuck in my brain, like the crew, the JP crew videos of them skinny animals alive. I hate JP crew. I would never buy their products. I hope no one else does. They're cruel. What they do is horrendous, and I don't need anything that badly. So, well,
my whole ensemble is JP Crew. No,
you
teasing.
Better not be throwing paint on your ass in June.
Yeah. Well, my rose and thorn of the week is, my thorn has to be the Meghan Markle and Prince Harry debacle.
That is a pain in the ass. Is it not?
I mean, I'm like, who cares? I mean, if they want to break off and live wherever they're, just as long as I don't have to pay for it, I could give a shit. And the
I'm
whole
just
race
here for
is,
the comments.
And the whole racist issue about it, and I'm gonna be a bit blunt here, is that if you'd mentioned to anyone on the street about anything about Meghan Markle, no one brings up her race whatsoever.
This is a bring up that race card. Race baiting prevails.
Well, it's just a media thing. It's just media thing that there's a media circus, and it's really stupid. Now, for whatever reasons, what they want to do, I mean, you can't help what vagina you come out of. So if he doesn't want to go in the family business, he should have that right.
Right.
But can we just move on from it? This is like, it's just consuming every single news thing over here. It's horrible.
Yeah, and can we go back to the whole Smith Munn thing? Like, it's all fake. Like, they're coming over here because they get to come over here now, because we're not, like, against royals moving into the U.S. for some
reason. Well, actually, they're going to Canada. She doesn't want to come here because she doesn't like our president, so that's fine.
Again, supposedly, like, that we know of. It's all – this is like pro wrestling. It's kabuki theater. It's all staged. Like, it's literally all staged.
Friday Night Smackdown.
Hey, let's talk about the fact that they're cousins. I mean, Meghan and Harry are literally cousins, and it's like, haha, through some like ancestor thing. But no, it's because the lizard reptilian people love to intermarry.
Don't get me going on the reptilians.
Yeah, so yeah, they're inbreeding because they're cousins, because they're royals. Ha ha ha, it's all fake. And I'm with you. Yeah, the less we hear about them, the better. And if it doesn't cost me any money, cool. But they basically own all the money anyway, so...
they're Canada's problem right now. They're not ours.
Yeah, well, Canada's not doing too well anyway, so God bless them. Yeah. So, my rose of the week is that we've been nominated for Rondo Award. We haven't been shortlisted, but we have been nominated for Best Podcast of the Year. Nice. So, that makes me quite happy. And something that makes me happier is something a bit more close to my heart is Titan Season 2.
I can't find it over here. I looked. It's only a UK thing right now, dude. Can't find it.
Yeah,
but well, I will find it.
You have to find it on the Warner Brothers network, whatever that is over in the US. It's a Warner Brothers show. So they have their own web, you know, their own Netflix kind of thing.
Is it sort of like the CW?
Kind of like CW, but I think WB runs more like Hulu or Stars.
Oh, okay. You know, okay, gotcha. Maybe it is on Stars. I got Stars. Now I got to look.
But Titans is fantastic. Season 2. Bruce Wayne's played by Ian Glenn, who was in Game of Thrones. And yeah, very, very good.
They're making a sequel or a prequel to Game of Thrones. I'm kind of happy about that. But
yeah, we'll wait and see how that goes. I just think that, I don't know. I think we kind of know the whole story. So anything they're going to do might be a retread, but I'll keep an open mind. So as far as that goes. And other than that, yeah, my life is still clicking on. Oh, I guess another thorny thing is I have to work. If I could choose what vagina I came out of, it would have been rich parents. But A, that's the way life is.
I don't so, even want to think about the vagina you came out of, Keith. Well, your poor mother.
Well, I'm going to let that settle there. So that brings us to Possession, the 1981 psychological horror drama film directed by Andrzej Zulawski. I'm sure.
Did you say that right?
Probably not.
Yeah, we always butcher somebody's name every week.
It was written by Zulawski and Frederick Tootin, and starring Isabel Ajani and Sam Neill. The plot obliquely follows the relationship between an international spy and his wife, who begins exhibiting increasingly disturbing behavior after asking him for a divorce. Possession is an international co-production between France and West Germany and was filmed in West Berlin in 1980. The film debuted at the Cannes Film Festival, where Ajani won the award for Best Actress for a performance. It was Zulawski's only English language film. In recent years, has been developed a cult following. As they were filming in West Berlin, the director has stated that he wrote the screenplay in the midst of a messy divorce. Special effects artist Carlo Rambaldi assisted in creating the technical creature that is featured in the film. The shot was emotionally exhausting for Aljani, and it was rumored that she attempted suicide after filming completed. Viewers have found it difficult to properly classify this as a drama, horror, or suspense, though elements of all three are present in the movie. What we're going to do is cut to the trailer, and we'll be right back after our trailer.
Oh, Mark, your wife keeps her own secrets.
Make her talk to me. It'll be the way that she wants.
Tell me.
Well, I think what you want to do to Bob is just...
inhuman. So what you're doing must be human.
After you!
I'll stop coming!
Why I have to go!
I'll follow you!
You can hate me as much as you like, but it's you who wants to know things for me. So please make it possible.
First time, you look vulgar to me.
You are no different from anyone else. We are all the same, but in different words, different bodies, different versions, like insects. Meat!
What is it?
Welcome back to Literary License Podcast, and we're discussing the 1981 Possession, which is part of our Obsessive Love Disorder, or the Spirit of Love Month. So I was going to start with Vicky about talking about this film, but I think we should start with Will first, so he can give us a bit more insight about this film. So Will, yes, what are your thoughts about Possession?
Will.
Okay. I'm gonna kind of approach this. I was hoping that I could go last, but I think it's better that we just kind of get some stuff out of the way.
Oh hell no! You picked this one out.
Well, if you want, I'll tell you what. We will do them. Let's go slightly off script, and we'll start with Vicky, then me, and then I think that you can help put us maybe
together. I'm gonna drop some stuff on this. So yeah, come back to me. It'll be worth it. So
Vicky, what are your thoughts on Possession, the 1981 European horror film we're covering this month?
This has got what the fuck award. Because I was like, what the fuck, through the whole movie. My husband was like in the other room when I was watching it going, what are you watching? But I mean, as far as obsessive love, this one definitely gets the gold. I've never seen anything like it. I mean, I watched it twice because I had to, because it kind of goes fast. And you're trying to figure out what's going on. It's a quick movie. It doesn't let you sit on your hands at all. And Sam Neill, I mean, you know, he does the great paleontologist. You see him in Jurassic Park and stuff, and he's all warm and fuzzy. Well, he's just freaking weird in this movie. It's almost like he's like the teenage Damien or something, but he's a spy slash husband who's obsessed with his wife. And he's just creepy weird in this. I mean, he just is. I mean, he almost reminds me of, you know, Psycho or something. I mean, and she had an exhausting performance. So she, the what was her name? How do I say her last name?
Isabel Johnny. Yeah.
Yeah. If I had to do that performance, I would be a little exhausted too, and probably almost kill myself. I hope it wasn't true that she did that. But she had an exhausting performance. Talk about, you know, taking one for the team. She did on just like every shoot, every part of this movie. I mean, right down to where all that stuff was coming out of her when she was beating the milk against the wall in the tunnel, whatever that was. Was it a miscarriage, I think they said, from the tentacly whatever doppelganger thing? But it was the ultimate obsession love kind of movie. I wouldn't even call it love. It was just twisted obsession. You know, you have to watch it. It's sort of like a Monty Python movie. I can't explain. You have to actually watch it, and then you'll know what I'm talking about.
It's a puzzle box. Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of things I just want to point out, and I want you to think about it. And then I'm gonna drop some stuff later on. Remember that this movie was banned like out the wazoo. Like it was banned in so many countries, it's not even funny. But when you really think about it, and when you line it up against movies like The Evil Dead or the Texas Chainsaw Massacre or some movies with like, you know, hardcore like rape or torture in them, like Last House on the Left or I Spit on Your Grave, this movie was buried. It was buried. And you have to ask why. And I'm going to get into the why, and it has a little bit to do
with... Well, it was really raw. I haven't seen, sex with the tentacly beast. That kind of reminded me almost of Humanoids from the Deep, but yet it was freakier. Yeah.
You're not thinking deep enough, though. However, there is one other movie I want you to think about when you're thinking about this movie, and that is the Suspiria remake, the one that happened a few years back.
Right.
Remember that it was actually, if you think about that movie, it was shot on the same street, and the creature attack happened in the same house.
I didn't know that.
Where the witches lived in the Suspiria remake. Or not where they lived in, I'm sorry, in the opening scenes of the Suspiria remake where, what's her name? The child actress who's hiding out from the witches, you know, where she goes and sees the shrink, that's in that building. So anyway, I'm sorry. I just kind of wanted to say that while you were talking
about that. That's an interesting little factoid because I didn't know that. I have to go look now.
I'm so sorry. Please.
No, it's okay. For me, Possession, I did like it. It's one that kind of stays with you, and you have to like play it through in your mind. I found like after hung up, I do have to sit there and say that I do feel sorry for the people who lived in the same building as these two. Because,
no kidding.
I mean,
Can you imagine being their neighbor?
I do have to wonder why the police or Child Protective Services wasn't called at any time during
that
this film.
That poor little boy. Oh my God.
But but I found that another thing quite interesting is that Sam Neill, after doing this, went right into doing Omen 3 the same year.
Yes.
They definitely had the mindset for it after this movie.
And I do have to sit there and say that Sam Neill did get better looking with age.
Yes.
I'll have to put that out there.
He's just creepy looking when he was young. I don't know why. Just creepy.
Well, he kind of has that Malcolm McDowell kind of face thing going, sort of thing. I noticed.
And I found
with Isabella Gianni is I didn't really know her. I mean, I know that she was part of that big flop with Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman shortly after this film called Ishtar. Yep.
Heaven's Gate.
But then she kind of redeemed herself after this with what?
Was she in Ishtar or Heaven's Gate?
Ishtar.
Ishtar. Oh, okay. Ishtar. Don't even get me going on Ishtar.
Yeah, it was Ishtar. Because this was supposed to be her big, like, American debut. And of course, it was one of the biggest flops around. And it was a really bad film as well. Heaven's Gate is a bit different. It's one that people didn't go see, but it's actually a decent film at the end of it. Right. But this Ishtar was, like, bad all the way around. And then when I know of Isabel Ajani, she's in one of my favorite French films, which is Rien de Margot, or Queen Margaret, that came out in France, and she's the star in that. So I remember her from that. Mm-hmm. But, and then of course she does a lot of French films. So if you're familiar and you do watch a lot of French films, she pops up a lot. So, but I thought that with Possession, I found that for me, I kind of understand the mechanics, because it is about, for me, and I don't know if I'm going way off base, but if I'm taking this from how I viewed it, for me, it's about when a divorce gets messy, that people become different people until they come to the other end of it, and you kind of become reborn, but you're the same person, but kind of a different inside, because it just changed you.
Well, but I'm not sure. Divorce does that to you, though. It does put you on a different wavelength than thinking of life. So it is a marriage in ruins, and that's what divorce basically is. So,
and then when we get to the end, that's why I thought that's why they changed that. You know, that's why they have the green eyes, because it's changed them, even though they're the same person, but it's changed them, and they turned into doppelgangers themselves. That is my analysis, but I'm not sure if I'm completely right.
So. I think this is all open to opinion.
I don't think that there's a wrong or a right to this. I think that I really do believe that this movie is a work of genius, and I'll defend this movie to my very last, because it works on a lot of different levels. And you're right, the conversations that they have are painful, and they're like, it's like watching an opera when they go back and forth at each other. And it does resonate. And you think of, like, the most nightmarish, like, breakup scene that you've ever had, cranked up to 1,000, where everyone's emotions are just as raw as they could be. That's what it would look like. And it would look like bad opera. And it would look like people not even behaving like themselves, but like a projection of themselves. But again, that's just, I think that that's just one way of looking at this movie. But I think that there's a hidden sort of message to it that I'll jump into whenever you guys are ready to.
Well, they kind of had me at the electric knife.
Yes, absolutely. That was so intense. Yeah.
I did find it's kind of bizarre, because apparently while Sam Neill's away, Johnny has an affair. Mm-hmm. But then when she asked, I found what's quite interesting, that, and then he's kind of like bothered, or it seems like not bothered, but you can tell that he is bothered, since one of those kind of situations. Mm-hmm. But then when she turns the tables on him about him sleeping with other women, he seems to say he has as well.
Right.
So it's almost like this kind of thing, like, okay, you're a bad person because you've done this, but I'm doing the same thing. So, and I always found that a bit, you know, I thought that the way that was played out was quite interesting, but it's quite funny because they made quite a statement about her doing it, and it kind of follows through all the time, but he kind of mentions it himself, but yet it's kind of like shoved underneath the rug.
Do you think it's because it was still late 70s, early 80s era, and it was still the double standard kind of thing? Lovecraftian kind of crap?
Well, not really, because we're dealing with a French-German production, and they don't shy away from this. Americans are good, you know, American filmmakings are totally different animal altogether.
Right.
The French and German...
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. Like, this is not a movie... This is not a typical American movie with a hero protagonist and a villain.
No, it's not at all.
There's these people are playing very different sorts of roles, and they're structured differently. So you can't look at his character as the hero. Or if you did, this would be the worst movie in the world. But it's, again, it's not structured like that. It's giving you a different sort of story and a different sort of message.
And I think another thing is that male and female roles in European cinema is totally different than what you're going to get anywhere else anyway. You don't have the female role, the female mother. If there is, there's something a lot more complicated about her. It's not, you know, the female, you know, as far as equalities go, female, you know, the European setup of the way the families are run and stuff like this is that even if with the woman's at home, she is the dominating force at home. She's not, you know, she doesn't have to, she's not an owner. The husband doesn't own her. She's her own person, you know, and the male. So you don't have those male and female roles that you normally would get in other.
It was a complex setup situation though. The movie was complex.
But I also think that we're also playing against, I think politics is also weaving itself in and out of this film as well, because we are dealing before the Berlin Wall went down.
Yeah, are you?
The wall hadn't come down yet, so right. We still got that going on.
1981. Yeah.
No.
So we're also dealing with the whole, you know, the Cold War that was mm-hmm. very relevant still at this point in time. So you got that weaving through the storyline as
and
well.
That's where they filmed it too.
Yep.
Well, you also get that, but you're also going to get that kind of sensibility that's going on at that time, you know, where you're basically one family's on one side of the wall and the rest of your family's on the other, and you're not allowed to see each other. So, because it's on the other side of the wall, though, as well, you do have these kind of weird conventions as far as what society is as well, that I'm not sure that us being from the West or anything like that, we're never going to. We can have a bit of empathy for it, but I don't know if we're really going to be able to understand it unless we actually lived it
right.
as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that had to be something, you know, your family stuck on that
tension,
side.
The tension was literally the stuff of nightmares. I mean, it was very real and like at any moment. And just think like just a few decades before, like they had seen open air executions in the middle of the street. Like that
right.
was a real thing that like people lived with. And then they had these fences up and they're literally pointing guns at each other around the clock. And that tension creates a whole different kind of psyche. It creates a whole different kind of mass consciousness in a group of people. And that mass consciousness can create some very spooky things. And that's why this is such a fertile hotbed, and that's one of the many reasons that the location of this movie is super important, but there's so much going on.
I mean, think about it. If you're in a high rise and you're on the east side of the wall in East Berlin, and you can look over the west. Meanwhile, you got the west and they got McDonald's and all these westernized good shopping and stuff like this, and meanwhile your side of it's just like a slum that you can never escape from,
right?
You know, it's not like you get a better job and escape into the nice area of town,
right?
You know, it's not like that. You're basically separated. And you can, but unfortunately you can see that separation. You can see what's happening on the west side, where everything's, you know, becoming a bit more, you know, freedom. You can you can choose your career. You can choose who you want to be. You can choose what kind of life you want. You can come and go. You can travel. And here you are, you know, 10 feet away, and you don't have those choices.
Isn't that crazy?
So
it was such a big thing too, because I remember I was in high school when the wall came down, and that was such a thing to behold. Really, that was such a pivotal point in history. I don't think the kids these days don't understand, you know, what we remember.
That was monumental. It was
but it was something to behold, watching that wall come down. Mm-hmm. And all of the partying that ensued after the fact, because there was so much happiness and relief. Yeah. So this movie was kind of brilliant, actually, where they filmed this coincide with the disintegration of the family that was going on and everything else.
This movie is, like I said, it's a work of, I will defend this movie to my grave. It was one of the greatest films ever made.
I had to watch it twice because I was totally lost the first time.
Because you're not watching, it's not told like you're not seeing an American film.
That's definitely not an American film.
You have to think about what you're looking at. And again, it's once you really see what's happening, it is super mind-blowing.
Yeah, like, it was confusing at first, but I mean, like European horror and whatnot, all their films, like on the other side of the pond, you know, yeah. It does seem to make you have to think a whole lot more than your typical, sorry, people, like slasher flicks, you know, with the teenagers who are having sex, get the spear through their bodies. It's just a little more than that.
Well, this is what I think, like, when horror stories are told right, what it is it's a subversive form of storytelling where you can get away with things that you can't say outright. And like right. I said, there's things happening on a lot of levels, and I'm going to go crazy deep into some of them when you guys are ready to. But
go right ahead, Will. Fire away.
All right. Are you guys ready? Did you?
Yeah, bro, I'm ready. Now, let's. Okay. I think we listen to what you have to say, and then I think we can comment from there, because I think you have a more fully formed.
Yeah,
I've been so excited to talk about this movie for so long, guys. You have no idea. So, to get into it, first of all, this is not this movie was buried for a very specific reason, and one of the main things that got this movie so much notoriety has nothing to do with gore, and it has everything to do with Sam Neill's character as a spy. Okay, now if you think of a spy in the average movie, even the most broken down ones are very heroic. Think of like the Bourne Identity or 007.
Right.
Those are the images of the spy that you're given. Now, in the 70s and 80s, they created a couple of different kinds of spy movies that were very much buried in these movies like The Manchurian Candidate. Now, think about how Sam Neill looks in this movie. He looks like a cross between Lee Harvey Oswald and Frank Sinatra's character in The Manchurian Candidate. Okay? That is because Sam Neill's character as Mark, as the spy, is a broken and mind-controlled character. Okay, his character is actually modeled after a character in an AV, it's a science fiction story from like the 1950s, written by a guy named A.E. Van Vogt. This story is called A Violent Man, and A Violent Man was actually used as the right man archetype in Colin Wilson's studies of the occult. Okay. So you have a sort of mind-controlled, fragmented guy. This is reinforced if you go to the scene where he is being, what's the word for it, where he's being not deprogrammed. Well, he is being deprogrammed by those four gentlemen in the panel table.
Okay? Right.
While he's sitting there, if you think about the camera scope, it's actually moving around them in a circle. That circle is supposed to create like a sort of hypnosis. This is actually reinforced by the last thing that they say to him, which is, did your target like wearing pink socks? Okay. This could actually be slated as a post-hypnotic suggestion, something that would actually create missing time. Think about Sam Neill's character throughout the movie. He keeps like drinking and passing out, and 3 or 4 days go by. This could be like his sort of reaction to the bad breakup. He could be drinking himself into a stupor, or he could be experiencing missing time because he's a fragmented individual. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was exhausting watching him just stay locked in that room, just drinking.
Right. You know? Because he's got dissociative identities. He's got multiple identities. Okay. So that's just one of the things that's happening here. Okay, I'm going to break off from that really quickly and talk about Marge. Because again, I want you to see how many levels are operating throughout this whole movie. Now remember Marge. Marge is the character who he goes and sees to kind of get the lowdown on Anna.
The friend.
Right? Mm-hmm. So Marge is actually the devil. Okay, now, so like I said, I was talking about mind control. That's just one thing that's happening. And I'm going to point out like how many layers this movie has. So Marge is the devil. Okay, so she appears to torment him. She actually is summoned at a crossroads. If you see where he meets her at a crossroads. She comes out in a purple robe, okay?
Oh,
this
yeah.
This is a superior character. Not only that, she's wearing a black cast. So think about the devil. The devil is always slightly hobbled, okay? He always appears with like a misshapen lump on him or something.
Right.
Black cast actually is the devil. So Sam Neill's character actually sort of summons her to kind of get information, and that information tends to twist on him. All right. So there's that sort of happening in the movie. Going back to the whole mind control aspect, the reason that it's happening, where it's happening in that in the complex like it is to reinforce the idea of a hive mindset. So these people both have fractured identities. All right. the reason for her sort of ballet, if you remember the scene where they're in the ballet school together and she's having the breakdown where she's holding the kid up, they're talking about the implanting of memories in the form of negative samskaras in that. That's why if you ever see movies about mind control with women, think of like the Scarlet or what's her name from the Marvel movies, the Black Widow. She's in the ballerina thing where it's all mind control. Mind control in ballet has there's a sort of spy current that's moving through Berlin at that time that was very active. So the Soviet Berlin sort of link to the fact we don't know that Anna might actually also be a spy of some kind, because that's why she's having all of these breakdowns as well. So all of this could be happening on a lot of different levels. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
a lot more now. I would have never, with the crossroads and the purple. Yeah. I didn't even think of that when I saw that.
Right. So they're both having these like crazy supernatural experiences, but they both could be very fragmented people. Everybody in this movie is possessed in one way or another. They're possessed because they've allowed their psyches to get so split open in so many different ways that they're actually getting like run afoul by this demonic presence that only reveals itself after you realize that both of them have gone completely insane. They're not normal people, but you don't really know why until you've poked at that why. You get that?
Yeah.
Why was she trashing the house all the time though?
Right, because they're completely over the top. They're not actually like humans. They're like automatons, but that has a lot to do with him being a spy. And again, I want to point out the guy with the eye patch, he would be reminiscent of the connection between whatever Sam Neill's spy forces are at the very end. He's got like a long orange hair and the Crocs. That's sort of the MK Ultra mind control aspect that they've got. So Sam Neill is constantly like having these psychotic breaks because he's a psychotic individual because of the work that he did as the spy. You get that?
Right.
So again,
got that.
Sorry, I'm going to move forward a little bit. So I want to talk about Heinrich. Okay, so Heinrich is another sort of key element to all of the things, because they're talking about a lot of dark stuff in this movie. And that's, again, this got banned for talking about some very shaky things that you're not really supposed to talk about in movies. So moving forward to Heinrich. Heinrich is a German tantrika, okay? So he studies the tantra. That doesn't mean the same thing here in the U.S. that it meant in Germany in the 1940s and the 1950s.
You might want to elaborate on that, though.
I'm going to. Oh, I'm diving in. Are you ready? So let's get into Heinrich's age and sort of what he is very specific. If he's at that age in the 1980s and in the 1940s and the 1950s, he was studying occultism in Germany, okay? And his sort of Aikido tantric martial arts that he's throwing out there would link him to either theosophy or some kind of OTO kind of a sort of a sex magic link, okay? Right. And that's what this movie is kind of leaning into. We think of the tentacle thing as almost like Alien, but remember, this is a movie about possession, so this is something demonic. So this was something that was called forth by Anna and Heinrich at some point, okay?
Right.
So Heinrich is probably some kind of Aleister Crowley / Theodore Rice, Carl Germer type. These were like the sort of sex magicians that were popping up in the 1930s and 1940s.
Oh, man.
So remember I was talking about A.E. Van Vogt in the beginning? I'm going to kind of link all the way back to that. So if we have Heinrich as sort of this Aleister Crowley-esque sex magic-y tantrika guy, right? And they're performing some kind of gross demonic rituals, then the link back to A.E. Van Vogt through Sam Neill's type is through Scientology, because A.E. Van Vogt was actually a... before Scientology, there was something called Dianetics.
And right. Oh, yeah.
A.E. Van Vogt was a Dianetic therapist. Okay, so this is tying American mind control into German sex magic, all under the rubric of spies. Okay.
Okay.
That's actually what this movie is really about, and that's why it's really kind of controversial and gets buried. Okay. They were talking about some really spooky stuff, and in a way that, like, again, you have to watch it and kind of know a little bit about the history of what's going on in post Germany or in post World War II Germany with all of these creepy spy factions. This movie is talking about some things that aren't really far off from what could happen, like, if you get really creepy into all that stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, it does to me.
Yeah. And once you throw in, like, the hallucinogenic factors of all, like, the MK Ultra, the Timothy Leary stuff, the drugs that were going into all of, you know, the intelligence factors back then, you get this sort of soupy stew of demonic and hypnosis and even like the Nazi sort of the Nazi occult science. You get into that with the twins, okay? And that's where you get
the
ideas.
Nazis
like,
at their hand in just about everything supernatural.
Yeah, really it's hitting on so many different supernatural things. Not even to mention the fact that the names are super important. So you've got Mark, who's sort of the Mark. He's the guy who's at the center of this great big, you know, if you look at it from the Merry Pranksters point of view, this would be like a horrible joke played on the Mark. Okay, Bob and Anna are both palindromic names. The palindromes are sort of things that pop up with aliens. In this sort of creepy, like, intersection of occultism and spies and all of that that they're talking about back then. So that's another sort of hit. And then there's a few others, but you get it, right? Like, you see that this movie is talking about some crazy things that
what a crazy movie. When you incorporate all the things that you're talking about, it kind of makes perfect sense now.
Yeah.
I actually know what you're alluding to, so.
Yep. So there you have it. That's the reason for everyone's insane behavior, and that's the reason that the movie kind of turns on the wheels that it does. And it's, again, this movie could never get made like today, I don't think, in any country. And the fact that
I think it would just call a big hullabaloo if they released something like this. You know,
yeah.
You can't get away with this shit no more.
The fact that it got made at all is kind of a minor miracle. But it's also, if you look at Andre Zula, I'm not even trying to say his name. I can't pronounce it. But he's got a couple of really crazy movies out. His first movie, The Devil, came out in 1972. It's been banned pretty hardcore too. But it talks about like the medieval version of what this might have looked like. So whereas this movie takes place in modern day, The Devil takes place, I think, in like 1792, and it's a hard movie to watch, but it's like if you were to replace spies with like witches and sort of the Inquisition, it's kind of that story told all over again.
They kind of try to link it to Roman Polanski's Repulsion too. Only she didn't.
Oh my goodness!
Catherine Deneuve.
Holy cow, I never saw that, but you're absolutely right. I could totally see how the two would be linked. That's really cool.
And I guess you could also tie it in with Lars von Trier's Antichrist as well.
Absolutely, yes. Antichrist is a good movie to compare this one to. Also very hard to watch. Sam Neill, he's done some pretty interesting movies. If you compare this to The Omen, to like The Mouths of Madness, you know, he's got a really interesting filmography outside of Jurassic Park.
He's a very diverse actor. A lot of people only know him as in The Omen or in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
So he's been kind of pigeonholed into this, and no one really pays attention to his earlier work.
Well, to be honest, I think that the only mainstream film that he ever actually did was Jurassic Park. Two films. Well, now the third film that's currently being
coming out.
Moment.
Yeah.
But before that, he was always indie darling. I mean, The Piano
was, and
things like that. You know, it's kind of. Though I do have to admit he did get better looking when he got older. So he did have this kind of he did have this kind of weird, you know. Kind of a weird Malcolm McDowell. You could see him in those like those really odd British films from the late 60s, early 70s. You could see him being fitting quite comfortably with the look that he had in the early 80s and those kind of films.
Kind of reminded me of Goodman from the film we did last week.
He's like Udo Kier's stranger and more intense little brother.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. And then, and before he got his bottom teeth fixed as well, I'm noticed like, oh my God, has his teeth always been that way?
Just the way his vision fixates or something. He just looks like he's insane. He plays a good insane person.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I mean, Sam Neill is always, I always found him always being a bit odd. Odd in a good way, not odd in his like
right.
funny way. Because the thing is like, you can picture he plays these really, really odd roles, but he's, I think what makes him odd is that he plays all these bizarre characters throughout most of his careers until the one that everyone knows him for. But you know, at home, he's probably the most conservative guy ever.
Probably is. And he's just, I don't know. I wonder if that, do you think that the role was so exhausting for her that she actually, or is that just a bunch of crap that she tried to kill herself and just try to?
I don't know. I worry a little bit because, like I said, this movie kind of touched so close to some spooky stuff that I'd be concerned for anybody who took on a role like that and didn't quite, like, you know, protect themselves, you know, mentally from the challenges of thinking about those sorts of things.
I mean, another thing, we don't know how many takes they did
exactly.
for these kind of films. And if she's using this mental anguish, and to be honest, she does, there's no soft side to her. The only soft side she gets is probably when she's putting those green contacts in. And playing a slightly different character. And then again, I remember you got to remember contacts in those days. She probably still wasn't very comfortable, you know, in those days. No. Color contacts were hard. They weren't the soft contact lens. They were the hard contact lens. So I imagine even that hurt, you know, she's having a bit discomfort showing a character that was comfortable. So
well, what about the guy operating the Steadicam? Don't you think he was ready for a vacation after all the scenes he shot?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But I do think that when you were mentioning about, you know, the tearing up of the flat and stuff like this, when they were living in that, I also think that stands in a great territory that a home is the base of your marriage.
Right.
And if you keep that tight and clean, and you can either do it two ways, you can either make it look lived in, or you can do a controlled situation where basically, you know, you go on the picturesque home, you know, where everything's there. But that means that there is a controlling aspect in that home that's keeping everything tidy. With her tearing everything off the shelves, that just necessarily means that the home is no longer the safe place it's meant to be. The home is now messy and it's being destroyed and it's having a devastating effect on those.
It's almost infected at this point.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I want to mention one other thing about, so did you notice that they would tear the home apart, right?
Right.
And then, like, a few scenes later, they would cut back to it, and it's put back together again, right? And this happens a lot throughout the movie. And, again, that's another suggestion of missing time and them having handlers, them having people that kind of come in behind them and sort of tidy up as if they're being kind of positioned throughout this.
I guess so. Another thing that kind of plays with the time is the simple fact that Isabel Ajani, when she's her characters never change their dress. She's always wearing the same dress.
She does, and it's getting dirtier and dirtier throughout the film. She never does change clothes, does she? That's true.
Yeah, I mean, he changes clothes. He goes, you know.
Well, he does. She does.
Gray to brown, but she doesn't at all. So every time she appears, she's wearing that blue dress. And and at the beginning, it's fastened up. But I notice as the film goes on, there's less and less buttons being fastened in the back.
Right.
Yeah.
She's unraveling.
I also thought it was quite interesting, and I'm kind of wondering if Clive Barker is a fan of this film, because there is a plot device that's being used with the part of the creature that's going to slowly get the new doppelganger, who's going to give birth to the doppelganger of Sam Neill.
Right.
Yes.
Where basically you have the more deaths that are happening, the male deaths that are happening, it seems to be feeding the creature to bring it to full, like Uncle Frank in Hellraiser.
Right, right.
And I thought that was quite interesting that that's used in Hellraiser. And I'm kind of wondering if this is a nod to this film after seeing this film. Because this film's what, 8 years before Hellraiser? Hellraiser?
Hellraiser came out in 88, 89.
Yeah, 88. So I'm just wondering if Clive Barker might have been a fan, because he does use that same, you know, as the more male victims are being fed to the creature, he becomes more human.
Yes, right. Very much so. And, you know, now that you mention it, there's almost a very stylistic sort of way that she creeps up behind each of them and bumps them off in a way that looks very similar to what's her character's name in Hellraiser? The way
Julia, she stalks her. Claire Higgins.
Julia, yeah. Absolutely. You're dead on with that.
If you look at the way, you look at where Uncle Frank is, you know, the dirty, you know, wooden floors and the dirty window behind it, even the setting is almost the same.
Right.
For sure. Yeah, huh.
Yeah,
and that
true.
Was because Barker directed Hellraiser, yeah?
He did. Directed it. So, and that's why I found, I was like, oh my God, this is like, actually it was Isaac who was watching it. And he's the one that came up with the Hellraiser significance. It's like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, good catch. I didn't, yeah.
Yeah.
But I do find, I think if you're looking at it from a layman's term, and let's say you're not into film symbolism or stuff like this, and you watch it, I think that you can get a lot out of it. I mean, as far as the performances are concerned, I mean, you can't fault a single performance in it. And no. Isabella Gianni's, I mean, can you imagine? I don't know how long this film took to make, but that's going to say it took 2 months. Mm-hmm. And I sit there and say, normally in a film, you work, you know, Monday through Saturday, and you normally get Sundays off. Can you imagine 6 days a week for 2 months, turning that performance in
day after day?
Yeah. No, they're all belting from, and I mean, not just her. I mean, they're all like super physical in how they're moving throughout every scene. As everyone gets more and more unraveled, those, like, it gets harder to even, like, the way that they're all kind of stumbling and slurring and stuff like that towards the end, it's tortured. And so, yeah, she's kind of at the helm of all of that, and I can't even imagine. Yeah,
I do find something also a bit interesting. I noticed with Sam Neill's character is that when he goes into complete meltdown, he's very, very ruffled and stuff like this. But then as he's getting together and he gets a pretense false image of himself, he looks like he's very, very tailored. But then there's always something that's slightly not tailored on him. It's like, if you look at him, but then when you look at him a little bit closer, you realize, like, you know, his sleeves might be slightly frayed, or his one collar will be slightly out of the jumper. So there's always like something that though he looks like he's put together, there's something about him that's not quite put together. He's giving an image of being put together.
Yeah.
Which I thought was quite interesting. Do you, for you, Will, as far as the murder of Heinrich. The murder of Heinrich, what do you think that symbolized anything about the way that he was murdered?
I don't know. I think that there's a great line, you know, towards the end where Sam Neill says, I met somebody who believed God was love, and I saw him drown in a river of shit. And I think was that now? Yeah, so I think that line was very intentional. I don't know if there was symbolism to the murder itself, but what I would say to that is I don't think that there's too many parts of this movie that are accidental. I think that there's too much happening that's deliberate. If you had said that there was some sort of story behind why he was murdered the way he was murdered, I totally believe it. I also think that it's very interesting, even the name Heinrich for somebody who was like the sort of driving occult factor behind this sort of chain of events in this movie was also the name of Heinrich Himmler, who was the German occultist who ran, you know, Germany into the ground, as a result of him being Hitler's guy, you know?
Right.
So, what about, now the thing is that, and this, I think it's the ending that kind of keeps things a bit unbalanced, is that from my feeling at the ending, now when Sam Neill's doppelganger comes to the fore, and basically the old Mark gets killed and new Mark's reborn, did he have different color eyes?
Yes. The movie, he had blue eyes, and then in the end when he's coming back, he's got green eyes. So yeah, he's fully transformed.
Okay, so that's what I thought. So what I didn't quite understand is that you got Bob, who's been practicing holding his breath underwater. So he goes goes into the pretending he's dead. So obviously because he doesn't want new mommy and daddy to, I guess, transform him, I guess. Is that what we're supposed to understand? And then what I don't understand is why didn't Helen let the new Mark in? Because you got Mark like climbing up on the walls, his silhouette. But yet if he's the new reform, like she's been reformed. Now I'm assuming that she's the new doppelganger of Julia, I'm assuming.
Yes. Yeah, I think I can't have like a complete satisfactory answer for that. I think that in the same way that there's no true hero to this movie, what I would suggest to that is I don't think that Helen is a truly evil creature any more than maybe even New Mark isn't an entirely evil creature. Maybe these things are just alien. Maybe they're just alien and they're either good or evil in ways that we can't understand. And I wouldn't be surprised if the guy who directed this movie even saw it that way, even though there's so much evil going on throughout the movie. So to that, I would say, like, both Anna and Mark throughout the movie are pretty horrific. I mean, they're killers, they're murderers, they do horrible things. Helen, who comes back through whatever black magic they're working, is an actual benevolent creature. She's kind to Bob. She's kind to Mark. And she works as a teacher. She's not, we don't know if she's actually eating children in the basement or anything like that, but we have no reason to believe it based on what we're seeing. So maybe Bob doesn't want to get assimilated, and maybe he will and maybe he won't, but you know, the fact that he doesn't want to probably doesn't have too much bearing on these two creatures either. They're going to do whatever they do for good or ill. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, what I also found quite interesting is that Anna's character, she's very kind of old school way of dress, and you got Helen, and basically,
oh, she's rocking.
Yeah, it's new rocking, but everything's like very clean, very, very of the now, that 1981 style. And I find that when Mark is kind of still holding on to this old dress style and stuff like this until he's reborn. And then what we get is we get the yuppie look, what I call yuppie.
Yeah.
And this is at the same time as the birth of yuppie. So it's almost like the birth of consumerism as well, because this is like the start of it.
For sure.
And whenever Helen is, I found that, as far as the flat, it was ever Helen enters the flat or Helen takes care of the house is always very pristine and everything looks very, very clean. But whenever Anna enters anywhere, it's always very dirty and very messy. And
goes to hell in a handbag quick.
Yeah, sure. but even like there are times, and then, but then there are times though that the house would be really, really messy. But as soon as, you know, I guess this deals with Will's, you know, the concept of time that's held here, that Anna will be there. Anna leaves, Helen shows up, and the house is pristine again.
Right. So and there's even something to that, which goes back to that meeting he had with his handlers, which was, I don't want to be a spy anymore. Why not? Well, I'm having family problems. Would you like some help with that? And then immediately there's this chain of events and he runs into Anna. So we don't know who's, so here's the question. Did Heinrich implant the demonic presence, or was it the handlers, or was it kind of a bit of both? How do we know who's sort of running everything at the very top of, like when you're looking at the sort of intersection between, you know, demonic forces and post-World War Germany intelligence forces, how dark is it going to get? Like, does that, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. See, up until you gave us your
analogy,
your analysis of it. See, I looked at it slightly different. Mine was like, basically what we got this couple who are going through a really messy divorce and a very messy breakup.
Yeah.
And basically, in order to become their true self, they kind of have to kill themselves to become the new self, like you have to do in divorce. But unfortunately, what you have is all this mental trash and garbage, which basically was the slimy creature for me.
Yeah.
And so that this is the after effect of what you have. Yeah. And until you deal with the slimy creature, that you're never going to actually be reborn as a new person that you need to be to seek out another relationship. And that's kind of how I looked at this film. But yours makes a lot more sense because mine has some flaws and there's some stuff in the shadows.
You see, it also works on that level. And again, that's why I love this. Like, I'm not kidding. I think that this is a great movie. Like, I know that it's over the top and there's, you know, an actual woman having sex with looks like a space octopus at some point. But in spite of all of that, it speaks to things on levels that like you walk away from it just thinking a little bit differently about things, even if all you're thinking about is I really need to be like nicer to my partner or to the people in the street or whatever, because I think it kind of reinforces that too. Like if you're watching this movie and you've, you know, kind of thrown yourself, you know, at somebody a little bit too forcefully, maybe you're like you'll kind of pull back a little bit, you know.
See, I thought when I saw her miscarriage, how I broke that down for me was that basically just before that miscarriage happens, there's that thing that you can tell that she still cares for Mark, and that there's like there's that hint that they might be able to reborn their relationship, but because of what happened, then she kind of leaves and go back to whatever life she has outside their house, that all of a sudden that she comes to the understanding that any kind of rebirth of their relationship is futile. It's never going to happen. So it symbolizes the loss of that relationship that she thought could be reborn. That's not going to happen.
Right.
And that's how I looked at the miscarriage.
Yeah. I mean, again, it works that way, you know?
Yeah. But I think, it's quite interesting that this film now is that, now I didn't buy the DVD or Blu-ray of it. I actually watched it through Amazon Prime. And
Amazon Prime?
I had to really search for it. I had to like go on a pirate site because I had a hard time finding it.
Well, in this country, we have our Amazon Prime deals.
You get different Amazon Prime, yeah. In America, you got to get this on DVD. I don't think it's available anywhere else.
But I thought it was quite interesting that all the versions that you can get if you download, and the only version you can get over here is the extended 2-hour and 3-minute version. You can't get the shorter version, which is quite good, which is quite interesting because normally it's the other way around. You can find the theatrical print. It's the director's cut that's very, very hard to find. But here it's the other way around. You can't find the original 93-minute cut here at all.
Yeah, I've actually only ever seen the full version of it, for which I'm grateful. I think that this is a movie that, for again, it's also insane. I mean, it's an insane, bloody, gory horror movie where everyone dies horrible deaths, but it's also really good. Like, it's just a great movie. I'm glad I've only ever seen the longer version of it.
Yeah, I don't know what the shorter version is at all, but I thought that was quite interesting. Only the longer version stands now, which said before, it's normally the other way around. You can normally get like a director's cut and that's out for a very short time, but you know, it's a theatrical cut that's being shoved down your throat left, right, and center.
Well, they said it was banned because they considered it one of the notorious video nasties, and they only released it uncut on VHS and DVD in 2000 by Anchor Bay Entertainment.
Well, you know, as far as the video nasties thing here in Britain is concerned, and we'll probably cover this a lot more next season when we start doing UK horror. But the video nasties was this kind of weird situation that went through. And basically Britain was in the throes of Thatcherism and a bit like the America in the 80s with Reaganism and stuff like this. There's this conservative thread going through. Yeah. And so the person who would start off the video nasties was this person called Mary Whitehead. Mm-hmm. And she kind of started this, and basically it's about what are we going to do about saving our children, and of course this scenario comes across about every 20 years, and we're starting to come up with this again. This is going to start reborning itself in the politics in the next couple of years, this whole thing about how are we going to save our children,
right?
And we had and at this time it was films in the, you know, in the 80s, the video nasties, because people, you know, you can take videos home, take them in, you can watch them. So what they started to do with the video nasties thing is not, and no one was viewing these films. Nobody from government was viewing these films. They're going by the look of it, word of mouth, or something, but none of them saw Evil Dead. None of them saw I Spit on Your Grave. None of them saw these things. They just kind of looked at the book, looked at the cover, or looked at the name, and then what they do is they go, hey, this is banned, without even seeing them. So this was part of the video nasties. They could have done it because they did see it, and they thought, okay, this is too sensible for the public in the UK, or there's the word of mouth, so we're going to ban it, or the simple fact of they didn't like the cover of the video cover. And that might be the reason why they were banned, and that's how the banning was done over here for video nasties. So there was no rhyme or reason behind it. No. Now, again, 20 years later, early 2000s, we have the video game nasties. Like, oh my God, video games are carbon here. So, you know, now that 2020 is here, this is starting to brew up again. You're starting to brew up again about how are we going to save our children and blah-de-da-de-da. So we'll be going through another, I don't know what they're going to try to ban or what they're going to throw at us, but you know it's coming. So.
Well, we've all had our Tipper Gore moment already, so hopefully that isn't coming back anytime soon.
Well, it will come back, but it'll be something else. They'll go after something else, and it'll have to do with entertainment or something. Who knows? You know, maybe Netflix or Amazon's ruining our children. We need to ban it or something. Or it'll be something, because it's starting to rear its head now. You're starting to see it. You're starting to see it feed through the headlines a little bit or through the media stories. So
right.
But yeah, so that's why. So when it says video's nasties and this is banned as far as video nasties, yeah, it probably was banned for video nasties, but it might not be banned for the reasons that we think it was banned. It might be banned just because of word of mouth. Because said before, this Mary Whitehouse was a 65-year-old woman in the 1980s. And basically she started this thingy and Thatcher jumped onto it because it was a good political conservative stuff. Like how, you know, we're in the throes of yuppieism here, we're in the throes of, yes, let's spend as much money as possible because we're all socially mobile, but we need to save our children.
Everybody has their Carrie Nation.
Yeah. But I have to sit there and say though, when this kind of stuff does happen, sometimes in entertainment, you get the best to come out in entertainment.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. The more that they clamp down, like it forces everyone to kind of work harder. And
exactly.
You get people put their thinking caps on and give something a bit more interesting. I also, what's also I found interesting about Possession, between 1981 and 1985, there was a lot of very interesting cinema going on around this time as well. I remember at that time I was in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and I was going and seeing stuff like The Fourth Man, which we're covering next month.
Oh my goodness, yeah.
But we also had do you ever remember a film called Liquid Sky?
Yes, yes.
I didn't but I remember hearing about it. I have not watched that one.
Yeah, it's a little bit more. Well, go ahead, Keith. Liquid Sky is another one I could talk about, but please.
Yeah, but it has this time kind of feel about it, where it's like as you're watching it and you're not quite sure what's going on, but then when you leave it, you kind of start thinking about it, and all of a sudden it starts making a lot more sense. But it's kind of, I call them the 80s avant-garde films, I guess. I guess Possession would fit for me in this avant-garde film. And they kind of...
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This and Liquid Sky fit right next to each other. Liquid Sky, I think it's more fun. Like, Liquid Sky is kind of... Well, fun, I guess, is kind of a strange word for it, but it's just... Well,
Possession has better acting in it than Liquid Sky.
Liquid Sky is... It's more like... It's more like... It reminded me of... oh, my goodness.
It was kind of a new wave punk kind of, and it does have with the synthesizer score and stuff like this. And I guess Possession would be like the complete package, where Liquid Sky is kind of like the student film that was kind of like takes some leads out of Possession. So
yeah, did Brian Eno compose the score for Liquid Sky? Do you know that?
I don't know. I know that Liquid Sky is very, very independent. I would sit there and say it probably was a friend of theirs that they probably got high with in uni. So I would imagine
I mentioned that only because Brian Eno did the score for the new Suspiria movie, which again is shot almost on the same street as Possession is. Yeah. So again, there's that sort of same people are telling these very similar stories.
What I find quite interesting is when you say that, it's amazing that street hasn't changed at all. There hasn't been, because let's say the new Suspiria was filmed in 2018, let's say.
Yeah,
came out in 2017. But then you sit there and say that this film was probably filmed in 1980, so that street hasn't changed in those 20, even though the walls come down and stuff like that, there hasn't been a lot of change in that street.
No.
I'm glad. I think it's beautiful. You know, it's, again, that whole idea of Euro horror, the some of the buildings are literally hundreds and hundreds of years older, and some of them are even older than that, you know?
But I'm saying, like with Suspiria, though, I mean, they do pull the camera back, so you do see the street. So the street, there's no convenience stores. There's no, you know, they haven't been, there's no, that street hasn't been modernized at all. I mean, all the buildings are there, yeah. But I'm saying that's quite weird that, you know, especially with now with the EU and everything like that, where everything's a bit more, consumer, you know, we now are living in a globalized new millennium, and to be able to find an old street like that hasn't changed with new shops put in or anything like that. So that's quite interesting in its own right.
It is.
So I guess what we'll do is we'll come to our final thoughts of possession. What I'm going to do, Vicky, we're going to start with you on our final thoughts of possession.
I think that's my WTF moment. that was really, well, I have to admit, it kind of, well, it was really good hearing your analysis of it because it really explains a lot for me and it all kind of falls together now. I'm probably going to watch it again.
Yeah.
Just because.
Oh, please. Yeah, please do, because again, it'll kind of, now that you see that, it'll start waking up. Because I've only touched on like the surface.
Everybody should watch it. I mean, it's just when you just don't see them like that anymore. I'm always, you know, in awe of the movies that, you know, some of you guys suggest that I've never seen or sometimes never heard of, because it forces you out of the box of typical Hollywood genre. And just see something different, because I really love European horror and stuff. I mean, that comes out of like movies that are on Shudder and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You don't have those here. You get tired of mainstream. You want to see something different. It's you know, refreshing, whether it's 30 years old or 3 years old.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's worth watching. I mean, it's got a lot more to it, you know, after you broke it down for me the way you did. So I am going to watch it again. But, you know, with that in mind, anybody that's listening to that, listen to the podcast, then watch the movie, or watch it first, then listen to the podcast, then watch it again.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's definitely something to watch. It's creepy as hell. It just really is. And it's worth watching. What about you?
I'm going to give my final say, and then we're going to go to Will to close this up, because I think he's got a better insight.
Yeah, he does.
To possession, it's quite weird that I saw the possession when I did, because on Shudder the night before, I watched this film called The Baby, which is a 1970s film about this. This is kind of slightly going off track, but you know, stick with me, folks. It's about this 1970s social worker goes to this house, and basically they're talking about the baby. And when they go to see the baby, it's basically this 25-year-old. Dressed as a baby, and the family take care of the baby. So, and I sit there and say, sounds really weird, but if you do look it up, you'll realize it's got fantastic critical reviews. And it's a good film. And everyone's fantastic in it. And it does have a Dark Shadows person in it as well. But then this leads me to Possession. I like Possession because it had this weird quality about it that's very slightly off-kiltered. And I do think that it is a film that if you're looking for something that you want, something that's totally out of the box of films, and I would continue this on with, like, you know, a lot of different films, like one we mentioned, like Liquid Sky. If you like your films are not, you know, or Eraserhead, or films of that earth, there are not going to sit there and explain everything out in detail. You have to watch them, let it pass through you, and then you step back and you're thinking, what the hell did I just see? And then it slowly all starts connect, the dots slowly connect after you watch the film. I think Possession works it that way. Another reason why I think you should see this film, that this is a fantastic acting tour de force among two actors who probably should be better known for what they're known for, basically, because Sam Neill gives a tremendous performance. Isabel Ajani gives a perfect performance. I would like to see any actress of today's ilk be able to get anything close to this performance. I don't think you're going to get it. I don't even think Meryl Streep could pull this out of her ass. I know, though she does pull a lot of other stuff out of her ass, but that's another story altogether. but I have to sit there and say that I do like this film. Unfortunately, though, for me, it's not easy viewing, so it's not going to be like, oh, what I'm going to do? Well, I think I'll pull out Possession, because I think it's going to be a film for me that I will pull out again, but there's going to have to be large intervals in between watching it again, but yeah. I am going to be seeing this film again, because I did actually like it. I did go to Vicky and go, you won't believe what I just fucking saw. I don't know what the hell this is, but I do like it, but I'm not quite sure why. And Possession kind of does that for me, but I like films like that. I like films are slightly on the edge and slightly not so. I don't like things all spelled out for me and stuff like this all the time. I don't mind films that do this, and I like a film that. And I like a film that, you know, after this discussion, I actually appreciate this film more, because I had what I thought the film was about, and then I have what Will's got it. What it's about, and I like that the film's actually me and what Vicky's come out with it, and I like the way that there's three of us here. We all got a different aspect or an angle on it, and I think that, you know, that my hat's off to the director and the screenwriter to be able to pull that off, because not many films can do that. So yeah. And what about you, Will, your final thoughts?
Yeah, I'd like to lead with that. I think that one of the things that makes this so great is that three different people can watch it and see three different things, and that's the mark of like good art. This is not it's not an easy movie to watch. It's not happy. It's not a lighthearted film, but I think it's a really good film. I think that first of all, everyone's acting is like you said, unbelievable. Isabel Aljani, I don't think there's a role that anyone's done quite like this. Yeah. We haven't even really talked about how good the special effects are. Like, you know, especially towards the end of the movie, when the creature really starts to take shape, there's a couple of shots in here that are, this is one of the best, it's one of the best like Cthulhu mythos type films that are out there.
Very Kafka-esque, isn't it?
Yeah, this is Kafka meets Lovecraft by way of Kenneth Grant. It's really, there's very few movies out there that are even like this. But I will say, if you want like an eye-opening weekend, I would pair this movie with Liquid Sky and maybe Mandy and the Suspiria, actually both versions of Suspiria. If you watch all five of those movies in a weekend, you're probably going to have to like lock up your doors for a week after, because the shadows are going to be doing different things than they are right now.
After, if you need a good psychiatrist, you can email me at.
I often wonder what kind of energy these movies pull into your life after watching all of these.
Yeah. Maybe don't do that. But no, it's definitely, there's very few movies out there like this. And I recommend it wholeheartedly. If you're into this show, I mean the podcast, I mean, if you're listening to us, then you're probably at least, you know, dip your toes in a couple of these movies. And this is one of those ones that it'll change your mind about a few things as you watch it. You know,
yeah, I agree.
That's what great movies do.
That's what they do, right?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Thanking.
So that brings us to the end of our obsessive love disorder, where we learned a lot of things. We learned that obsessive love disorder gives us great cinema. though we also realize it's probably something that we don't want to experience ourselves. So, yeah. But what we'll do is we're going to close the Possession of the 1981 European horror film by letting you know that you need to join up with our newsletter at www.llpodcast.com. And remember, if you join up with our newsletter, you're going to be wonderfully invited to some competitions coming your way. We'll be giving out t-shirts and some dolls that will be exciting starting in the month of March. And some of our competitions will be part of some interesting things. And I suggest that you do sign up for that. It's a monthly newsletter. At the moment, we're up to 850,000 subscribers. So thank you for all the people who are subscribing to the newsletter. And just let you know, and also let you know some interesting things. It also gives you some background information on some of our co-hosts, also some of our guests, and where to find some of their sites. Because I know that sometimes if you listen to a podcast, it's not always handy to have a pencil there to make note of every single web address that we give out to. So remember right. that's www.llpodcast.com. You can also find us on most of our social media sites, which also include Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest. Now, if you're looking for some exciting new photos from some of the films that we mentioned or some of the television shows that we've been mentioning, you can find them on our Pinterest account, which is getting lots of traction. You'll find some odd and interesting photos that you can't find anywhere else. Also, you can find us on some of your favorite podcast platforms. And of course, if you are listening to one of your podcast favorite programs at the moment, thank you. But if you're actually looking somewhere other podcast platforms that might be able to service you better, you can find us on iTunes, Amazon Alexa. We can also find us on YouTube, iHeartRadio, TuneIn Radio, Cashbox Radio, Podbean, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. So next week, we'll be covering Dark Shadows 158 to 177, where we'll be greatly entrenched into the Phoenix storyline as it's about to make its conclusion finally in March. So make sure you join us next week for Dark Shadows. Next month, we will be covering the Obsession of Love segments, and our first film will be House of Usher, book by Edgar Allan Poe, which is The Fall of the House of Usher, and House of Usher with Vincent Price and the Roger Corman film. So make sure you tune in for that. So that is good night for myself and good night, Will.
Hey, good night, Will. No, yeah. Hey, seriously though, guys, check out interceptthemovie.com. That's my buddy's film. It's going to be pretty great and just right along a healthier look, I think, at some of the space monsters that we saw in this movie. So anyway,
and you're gonna be able to find that on our show notes. We'll include all that information in our show notes as well.
Cool.
And good night, Vicky.
Good night, everybody.
And we'll see you next week for Dark Shadows.
This has been a Literary License Podcast production, and this was my will.